4. HMS Chihiro, 50, Garath Bay, Kingdom of Dolar. The Earl of Thirsk turned away from the stern windows as Lieutenant Bardalon ushered his visitors into Chihiro's great cabin. "Gentlemen," the Earl said quietly. "My lord," Kaitano Raisando, as the senior officer, replied for all four of them. "Please," Thirsk gestured at the four chairs facing his desk. "Be seated." They obeyed the politely phrased command, and he stood for a moment longer, considering them, before crossing to sit behind the desk. All of them, especially Raisando and Rosale, looked exhausted. In addition, Rosale was in obvious discomfort, despite a determined effort to hide it. His left elbow had brushed the arm of his chair in sitting, and the fingers of his left hand had twitched in an automatic pain reaction where they protruded from the sling. There was more than simple exhaustion or even pain in the shadowed eyes gazing back at him, however, and he folded his hands on the desk before him. "I've read your reports, and those of your first officers, your acting first officer in your case, Captain Krall. There are, of course, certain inconsistencies. Given the confusion of a sea action, it's scarcely surprising none of you observed exactly the same things. Despite that, however, I believe a clear and consistent picture emerges, and I have so advised Bishop Stiefen and Duke Thorast." He paused, and the tension in the quiet cabin could have been sawn into chunks. "I have fully advised them," he continued after a moment, in the same calm voice, "that I fully approve of your actions. That, in fact, I believe they reflect great credit upon all four of you, and upon your ship's companies." No one actually so much as moved a muscle, but it was as if four sets of lungs had simultaneously exhaled, and the Earl permitted himself a small smile. Then he leaned forward slightly over the desk. "Don't mistake me, gentlemen. I would have been even happier if you'd managed to take one or two of the Carizians, or for that matter, if we hadn't lost five ships out of the convoy and both galleys of the close escort as well." He smiled again a bit more thinly. "Which completely leaves aside the little matter of Prince of Dolar." None of the captains facing him replied, which didn't exactly surprise him. "I'm sure it comes as no surprise to any of you that I should feel that way," he continued. "For that matter, I'm confident each of you agree with me. But whatever we might wish, no one can simply snap his fingers and magically produce victory in a sea fight. True, you had the enemy outnumbered, and I won't pretend I haven't heard a few comments, all of them from individuals who weren't there, I might observe, to that effect. In every case, however, I have reminded those making the comments that your vessels were individually smaller, your guns were lighter, and that Caleb of Karras would have handpicked his most experienced captains for a deployment this far from Karras. In other words, gentlemen, in your very first battle, you were up against the other side's very best. Obviously, we don't want to get into the habit of assuming we'll always need a numerical advantage of 2-1. Nor, for that matter, do I think that situation will obtain indefinitely. For the moment, however, given the relative inexperience of your ship's companies and your officers, and how new all of us are to this style of naval warfare, I think you did extremely well. For the first time, a Carizian naval squadron has been turned back short of its objective. Yes, you lost one of your own vessels, and your casualties, especially yours, Sir Darrand, were severe. But at no time did you allow the engagement to degenerate into a rout, and your crews fought well from beginning to end. I see no evidence of defeatism on anyone's part, unlike the complete collapse of morale we suffered the first time we encountered Carizian galleons." His bared teeth bore very little resemblance to a smile. "Trust me, gentlemen. What I saw in Crag Reach when Caleb came sailing out of the teeth of a gale in the middle of the night was just that, a complete and total moral collapse. I saw ships under my command run themselves on shore, set themselves on fire, rather than face the Carizians in combat. I understand why that happened, and the shock of their firepower came just as great a surprise to me as to anyone else. But what strikes me most strongly about your engagement is that no one panicked. You didn't, your officers didn't, and your crews didn't. I'm sure that you also learned a great deal. That experience is going to stand the entire Navy in extremely good stead, and I'll be asking all of you to share it with your fellow captains. From a long-term strategic perspective, that will be a priceless advantage. As for our relative losses, while I'm sure all of us regret Prince of Dolar's loss, we need to remember how far from home the Carizians are. It's evident that at least one of their galleons was severely hammered. Their casualties may well be as severe as our own, and they, unlike you, are thousands of miles from replacements. By the same token, we have fully equipped dockyards and shipyards to deal with the damages to your vessels. They don't. At best, they have Claw Island, and I would hardly call Hardship Bay an ideal place to make repairs. Not to mention the fact that first they have to get there. Under those circumstances, I believe any impartial judge would be forced to consider the outcome of your battle as a draw at the very worst. In my own opinion, it was, in fact, a strategic victory. He shook his head. I'm sure some might conclude I'm simply trying to find a bright side to look upon. If anyone should decide that, however, they'll be in error. I'm not saying all your decisions were perfect, because they weren't, and in a few minutes we'll begin discussing where mistakes were made, what lessons can be drawn from them, and how they can be corrected. But you fought, and fought hard, and, completely irrespective of the casualties and damage you inflicted, the enemy's going to think two or three times before he divides his forces into such small squadrons again. That's going to have a significant impact on his ability to interdict our shipping. I've made those same points to Bishop Stiphon, to Duke Thorast, to Duke Fern, and in my own written report to His Majesty. And I've also made the point that our strength is steadily increasing. I intend, shortly, to take the offensive, gentlemen, and when I do, he looked them in the eyes, you and your ships will be in the van. All four of the captains, even Rosale, were sitting straight in their chairs now. They were still weary and worn, but their eyes glowed, and he nodded in satisfaction. He'd meant every word he said. Oh, he'd dressed it up a bit, glossed over a few parts, but in the main, he'd been completely sincere. Because they did do well, damned well, he thought. Even allowing for honest overestimates on their part, hell, even allowing for a certain amount of deliberate exaggeration on their part, they hammered the crap out of at least one of the Carizians. And the Carizians know that as well as I do. It's going to affect the way they think, how willing they are to take risks. And it's going to do the same thing for our own crews. We're not going to magically turn into the scourge of the seas overnight, but this action is the first step in convincing ourselves, and the Carizians, that Caleb's Navy isn't really invincible. And that, my friends, is worth every man you lost. Yes, and Prince of Dolar into the bargain. And now, gentlemen, he said with a smile, since I've reassured you of my approval, let's start examining those mistakes. But don't worry, I promise. His smile grew a bit broader, to be gentle. 5. HMS Dancer, 56, Trove Island, Gulf of Dolar. Sir Gwilym Manthier glowered across the dark, blue-black waters of Calm Bay. The sun had disappeared beyond the bulk of Trove Island behind him, and shadows had stretched themselves across the bay, turning its surface into ink. But the upper yards of squall and shield were gilded by the last level rays of sunset, reaching across Trove's heights. HMS Darts weren't, since she didn't have any upper yards. Work parties labored steadily on Captain Powell's ship. They'd already set up a new mizzenmast and a new main topmast, and given the ingenuity and skill of Carisian seamen, Manthir was confident they'd make the damage to her rigging good before Thirsk could react by sending a more powerful squadron to evict the squatters on Trove Island.
On the other hand, I think we can take it as a given that he'll be sending that squadron.
Manthir shook his head.
And before he does, I'm going to have to rethink my estimate of his combat capability.
He let his eyes rest on the fourth galleon lying to anchor in the small bay. Repairs to Prince of Dolar had actually been faster and easier to make, and although working parties still labored on her as well, she was essentially ready for sea. In most ways, Manthir was glad to see her. Her guns didn't match those of any of his other vessels, and all the ammunition he had for them was what was already in her shot lockers. Still, she represented a useful boost to his overall strength, and her capture was evidence of what Manthir's captains and crews could accomplish, even at 3-5 odds. As were the 50% casualties Captain Stewart had inflicted upon her Dolaran company. Manthir scowled as that thought reminded him of his own casualties, and why his gratitude at seeing the captured galleon wasn't unalloyed. His eyes moved back to Dart, and his scowl deepened. 84 of Powell's crew had been killed or wounded in the battle. Squall had escaped with only 3 wounded, but Shield had suffered another 32 casualties. That was 119 sailors and marines out of action, and 71 of them were dead. It was likely a third of the survivors would be permanently disabled as well. Even if they weren't, it would be a long time before they returned to duty. But the pressing point was that those casualties represented a third of a galleon's total complement, and his supply of replacements was limited. Very limited. The Admiral crossed his arms across his chest, leaning one shoulder moodily into the window frame as he contemplated that unpalatable fact. He'd anticipated personnel losses. Even aboard a Carisian ship, there were always ways a man could be killed or injured. Falls from aloft, accidents at gunnery practice, hands or feet accidentally crushed, moving any of the myriad heavy weights aboard a warship. Unlike some navies, at least drunkenness was seldom a factor in the ICN. Other navies, the pre-conquest Coruscantian Navy, and especially the Imperial Harchongese Navy came forcibly to mind, provided daily issues of rum to their crews. The men in those navies looked forward to their daily tots as a palliative for the boredom, drudgery, and, especially aboard Harchongese ships, misery of their lives, and more than a few spent as much of their time in an alcohol-induced fog as possible. Manthir was a naturally abstemious man, yet he had had nothing against alcohol. Nor did he begrudge his men whatever small pleasures they could find. The Carisian Navy's position for over 100 years, however, had been that drunkenness on duty was unacceptable. It was one of the few offenses for which the Navy still prescribed flogging for an enlisted man. In an officer's case, it cost him his commission. Fortunately, conditions aboard Carisian warships were far better than most of those other navies could boast. Carisian seamen seldom felt the need to escape into a drunken haze, and even if they had, opportunities would have been few. Not that alcohol was completely banned aboard Carisian warships. Their crews were issued beer, and good beer at that, every day, usually for their midday meal, for supper at other times. And rum was often issued for medicinal purposes or on celebratory occasions. But it was kept under lock and key between such instances and was nowhere near as available as in other navies. As a consequence, the accident rate aboard Carisian warships was barely a tenth as high as that aboard, say, a Harchongese galley. Accidents still happened, though, and despite all the Order of Pasquale could do about diet and hygiene, The packed living conditions aboard any warship, with its manpower-intensive crew and inescapably damp environment, too often became breeding grounds for disease. So yes, he'd allowed for a certain number of casualties, even exclusive of any which might be inflicted by enemy action. Unfortunately, it was evident his estimates had been low. The battle off Dragon Island represented the first true test case for what was likely to happen when the Imperial Carizian Navy confronted equally determined, properly designed enemy galleons, and it was clear to him that he'd been overconfident. Powell's small squadron had triumphed despite a significant numerical disadvantage, and Manthir strongly suspected his ships had inflicted heavier casualties than they'd taken. Yet from the squadron's reports, he also suspected that if the Doloran commander had been prepared to haul off to make repairs, then renew the action, the result might have been much less satisfactory.
"And whatever happened here, I'm down half a galleon's crew, probably more than that by now in the squadron as a whole, allowing for accidents and disease, and I've just added an additional ship. So where exactly do I find the men to man them?"
The question had a certain pertinency, yet at the moment it actually came second to a more pressing concern. The Earl of Thirsk was a tough-minded professional. He'd draw much the same conclusions Manthir had. And unlike Manthir, Thirsk was in a position of steadily increasing strength. It was unlikely a man like that, with the evidence of how well his captains had done at Dragon Island, wouldn't be looking for ways to use that growing strength.
"We should have brought more schooners," Manthir thought. "What I really need to do is to send a couple of dozen of them out to operate independently and raise Shan Wei's own mischief. Let them pounce on Doloran and Ha Chong'i's shipping in as many places as possible. That would force Thirsk to spread his galleons out, and he'd play hell running down any of the schooners. But I don't have enough of them to be everywhere they'd need to be, which means he's going to be able to cover his most important shipping in convoys, like he did at Dragon Island, and still free up the strength, if not now, soon enough, to try something a bit more offensive. And the only way I'm going to have the strength to stop him is going to be to keep my own galleons concentrated."
He didn't care for that conclusion. He was supposed to be whittling down the Church's naval forces, and his new appreciation of the Dolerman Navy's combat worthiness was going to make that more difficult. He knew he'd already imposed a significant delay on the Doloran building program. He'd captured or sunk too many cannon-laden coasters and shipments of turpentine, pitch, spars, and every other naval stores imaginable for any other result. And he was confident he could inflict still more delay, still more damage. But he was going to have to operate more defensively, and the less aggressive he could be, the less effective he was going to become.
"And if Thirsk is willing to commit to offensive operations of his own, the first item on his list is going to be Trove Island. And even if Major Windale's marines had enough heavy artillery to hold the anchorage forever, which they don't, there's a limit to how long a siege they could stand. If Thirsk has the galleon strength to drive us off, he could isolate the island with just a handful of old-style galleys. And if I don't have the strength to break through and lift Windale out, Thirsk will eventually starve him and his men into surrender, however willing to hold out they might be."
He sighed as he admitted that.
"Well, it's not the end of the world, Gwillem," he told himself philosophically. "Trove's been convenient and useful as hell, but it's not essential. You've got the transports Windale arrived on, so it's time you pulled him out and sent him back to Claw Island. That's a lot more defensible anyway, and by the time Thirsk starts getting any ambitious ideas about Claw, he's going to be a hell of a long way from his own ports. And in the meantime, you can probably raise quite a bit of hell with the Ha Chong'is."
He nodded sharply, turned and walked to the cabin door. He opened it and poked his head out.
"Yes, sir?"
Lieutenant Rosman said, looking up and then rising from his seat behind Manthir's desk, where he'd been working on the squadron's accounts.
I'll want to meet with Powell, Iwane, Stewart, and Captain McGale after supper tonight, Donald, Manthir told him. See to it that they're informed, please. And I suppose you'd better warn Niklos, too.
6. HMS Armach 58, the Karis Sea, and HMS Dawn Wind 54, Carter's Ocean.
What do you think about Gullum's new plans, Merlin?
Brian Locke Island asked quietly. At the moment, the High Admiral was stretched out in his cot aboard HMS Armach, his 58-gun flagship. Given the normal sounds of a ship underway through 6-foot seas, no one was likely to overhear him even if he spoke in a normal conversational tone. He had no intention of risking being wrong about that, however. Merlin Athrawas, sitting on the stern galley of HMS Dawn Wind, while he gazed out at the early dawn several thousand miles to the east, had no problem with that. He was just grateful Caleb had made it a priority on his return to Telesburg to bring Locke Island fully into the inner circle before the High Admiral returned to his fleet at sea. For the moment, Locke Island, like everyone else immediately after being told the truth, was being compulsively cautious, which was a trait of which Merlin approved.
I think they make a lot of sense, under the circumstances, he said now, in reply to the Earl's question. I have to admit, I was a bit taken aback myself by how effective Rysando's squadron was, he continued. I don't suppose I should have been. We've all been reminding ourselves for months that Thirsk is probably the most dangerous commander on the other side. But I was. His lips quirked. Maybe I've been a Carizian long enough to start suffering from that exuberant self-confidence that makes you so universally beloved by every other navy.
Exuberant self-confidence, is it?
Locke Island snorted.
I think it's a fair term, Merlin responded, smiling at the rising sun. Mind you, I never said it wasn't justified, normally at least.
I only wish we could talk to Gwillem this way,
Locke Island said in a rather more fretful tone.
I'm beginning to realize how maddening it must have been for Dominic to be able to talk to you and to Caleb, to see Owl's imagery.
He pronounced the still unfamiliar word carefully,
and not be able to tell me about it. But with Gwillem that far out on the end of a limb.
He shook his head and Merlin's smile faded.
I know, he sighed. In fact, it was something we discussed, Dominic and I, before Gwillem ever left. Unfortunately, we can only move so fast in bringing more people into the circle, and...
He broke off with a shrug, and Locke Island nodded.
I won't pretend I was happy about how long it took the Brethren to finally decide I was a sufficiently stalwart and trustworthy soul.
The High Admiral's lips twisted with wry humor.
At the same time, I can see why they might want to think about it for a bit before they start blabbing away about things like spaceships and counterfeited religions. And to be honest, I think it was probably a good idea to wait until Caleb got home to tell me about it in person.
He snorted again a bit more loudly. At least he had the authority to sit on me if I started running around in circles like a wyvern with its head cut off.
That thought did pass through our minds, Merlin acknowledged amiably.
I'm sure, Locke Island said.
Then he paused for a moment, frowning.
In the regards to that sort of decision, he said slowly then, I've been thinking about Alfred.
Don't worry, Merlin chuckled. They're planning on telling him as soon as he pays one of his visits to Telesburg. The healers aren't letting Charlian stir a step out of the palace until the baby's born, and she's determined she's going to be the one to tell him.
That wasn't my point, Locke Island said even more slowly.
He hesitated, like a man steeling himself, to say something he didn't want to, then continued anyway.
My point was that I don't know if it would really be a good idea to tell him at all.
Merlin blinked in astonishment. Despite the difference in their ranks, Baron Seamount was one of Lock Island's personal friends. The High Admiral had an even better appreciation than most for the sharp agility of Sir Alfred Hendrick's mind. For that matter, if anyone in the entire Carisian Empire understood exactly how critical Seamount's innovations had been, it had to be Lock Island.
So why?
Are you afraid he won't accept the truth about Langhorn and Bedard? Merlin asked after a moment.
You mean like Regis and Green Mountain?
Lock Island shook his head.
Oh, no. That's the least of my worries where Alfred's concerned.
Then may I ask why you have any reservations about telling him?
It's just...
Lock Island paused again, obviously marshalling his own thoughts.
Look, Merlin, he said then. I've known Alfred for the better part of 30 years. There's not a man on the face of the world I'd trust more implicitly. And God knows, I've never met anyone with a sharper brain. But there are actually 3 points I think need to be considered here. First, he's producing new ideas faster than we can put them into production already. Not only that, he's got his entire experimental board doing the same thing now, and all without knowing the truth or having access to all those computer records you've been talking about. I'll admit, I still don't really understand much about them. But my point is that Alfred's been forging ahead on the basis of the handful of hints you've already given him. As I understand it, your whole idea, in the long run, is for people to start thinking of these sorts of things for themselves, and Alfred's doing exactly that. Do we really need, or want, to divert him from stretching his own mind and the minds of people like Commander Mondrain into picking over someone else's records for ideas? Second, I do know Alfred. The instant he finds out he can have access to such advanced knowledge, he's going to dive in head first, and we won't see him again for months. He won't be able to resist it any more than a drunkard could resist whiskey, Merlin, and you know it. We can probably come up with some sort of explanation for his sudden disappearance, but it's going to be awkward. And in the same vein, once he knows what can be done, he'll move heaven and earth to get it done. I think there's a real chance he might end up pushing ahead too quickly. You've been very careful about not openly violating the prescriptions, but I have to believe restraining Alfred, keeping him from doing something that would clearly represent a violation, may turn out to be harder than you think. And conversely, if we avoid that, he's going to be miserably unhappy, knowing how much he could have done if only he'd been allowed to. But my third concern, and in many ways it's the most serious one, is how he's going to react to the truth, to the discovery that he could have been running ahead, learning things, discovering things, doing things, for his entire life, if not for the prescriptions of Zhuo Jing, and that the prescriptions themselves have been nothing more than a colossal lie. Caleb told me the Brethren were concerned about his possible youthful impetuosity if they told him the truth. Well, Alfred's no impetuous teenager, but I literally don't know if he'll be able to go on pretending he doesn't know the truth once he does.
Merlin frowned into the strengthening sunlight. He wasn't certain he shared Lock Island's concerns, but, as the High Admiral said, he'd known Seamount for a long time. In fact, he'd known him longer, and better, than anyone else in Caleb's inner circle.
I hadn't really thought about it from that perspective, he admitted finally, slowly. I'm not sure I agree. I'm not saying I don't, just that I'm going to have to think about it first. But I think it's definitely something worth raising with Caleb and Charlian before they tell him.
He grimaced.
Charlian is not going to like it if we decide against telling him, you realize.
Oh, believe me, I do. I do.
It was Lock Island's turn to grimace.
And to be honest, in a lot of ways, I won't regret it if I get overruled on this one. I'll worry about it, but damn it, Alfred's my friend. I want to tell him the truth, Merlin.
I just think this is something that needs to be considered very carefully.
I agree with you about that much, at least, Merlin sighed.
So you'll bring it up with Caleb and Charlian?
Instead of you bringing it up, you mean?
Well, actually, yes, Lock Island admitted.
Coward?
Absolutely, the High Admiral acknowledged rather more promptly, and Merlin chuckled.
All right, I'll do it. Michael and I need to talk to her and Caleb about Regis's correspondence with Gorgia anyway. We think it may be time to, push that process along a bit faster. I can probably work your little brainstorm into the conversation in my usual diplomatic fashion. On the other hand, she is pregnant, you know, and she's been more than a little irritable for the last month or so. I don't promise she won't hit the ceiling, however tactful I am. Still, he chuckled again louder, I'm still thousands of miles away. So if she does take it poorly, guess which one of us she'll be able to get her hands on first.
7. Archbishop's Palace, City of Telesburg, Kingdom of Old Karras.
The bishop is ready to see you now, Father.
Father Pater Wilson looked up from the small volume of The Testimonies he'd been reading as he waited to find out why Bishop Heinrich had summoned him to the Archbishop's Palace. The fact that he'd been summoned here, rather than to the bishop's own residence, suggested that it was both official and that it dealt directly with either the Church of Karras as a whole, since the bishop was deputizing for Archbishop Michael during his absence, or with the affairs of the Royal Council of Old Karras, upon which the bishop also sat at the moment as Steinar's deputy. Beyond that, however, he didn't have a clue, and so he'd striven to possess his soul in patience while he waited to find out. Now he stood and followed the underpriest into the archbishop's office. Bishop Heinrich stood, holding out his hand across the desk as Wilson entered the office. The intendant bent over the hand, kissing Wagner's ring, then straightened. Wilson liked the bishop, and he respected him, yet it still seemed subtly wrong to see him sitting behind Steinar's desk, be it ever so temporarily.
Just how Carisian have I become? Wilson wondered wryly,
then brushed the thought aside, folded his hands in the sleeves of his cassock, and regarded Wagner with polite attentiveness.
You sent for me, my lord?
Yes, yes, as a matter of fact, I did, father, Wagner replied, and pointed at the armchair beside Wilson. Please sit.
Thank you, my lord.
Wilson settled into the chair, but he never took his eyes from Wagner's face, and the bishop smiled slightly. Then he leaned back in his own chair, smile vanishing, while his right hand toyed with the scepter he wore around his neck.
I'm sure you've been at least mildly curious about why I asked you to come visit me today, Father.
I must admit the question did cross my mind, Wilson conceded, when Wagner paused.
There were two things I needed to speak to you about, actually, Father.
Wagner's voice was suddenly much graver, and Wilson felt his own eyes narrow in reaction to the shift in tone.
Before I deal with those, however, Father Pater, I want to express, once again, my condolences for the execution, the murder, of your father and your uncle. I have no wish to reopen the wound I know their deaths inflicted upon you, but I bring it up once more at this point because there are two additional things I need to say to you, and both relate to your loss.
Wilson's face tightened. Not simply with the memory of past grief, but with the tension of present worry. He hadn't heard a word from Lisbeth Wilson since her single letter had arrived. At least he hadn't heard of her or the children's being taken, yet that was very little comfort for his ignorance about where they were, how they were faring, or if they were even still alive. By now, even someone with his deep personal faith was beginning to feel almost frantic with worry.
The first thing I wanted to say to you, Wagner continued,
is that the manner in which you've dealt with this news has only deepened my already profound respect for you as a person, as a child of God, and as a priest."
The bishop held Wilson's eyes steadily.
"It would have been only too easy to fall into personal despair upon receiving such news, especially in the absence of any news about the rest of your family. And when the murders of so many of your father's friends and their families was confirmed, it would have been equally easy to turn against God himself for permitting such hideous crimes to be committed in the name of his church. You did neither of those things. Nor, despite your own loss, your own lack of information about your brothers and sisters and stepmother, did you falter for a moment in your duties as one of God's priests. Archbishop Michael has frequently mentioned to me the high regard in which he holds you. What I wish to say to you today, Father, is that over the last few months I have come to understand, fully understand, precisely why he feels that way about you."
Pater wondered what in the world he was supposed to say in reply. Whatever Bishop Heinrich might say, Pater Wilson knew himself too well to recognize the candidate for sainthood Wagner had just described. It was horribly embarrassing, and yet he couldn't deny it was also comforting. Not because he believed he was superior to anyone else, more important in God's eyes, but because it demonstrated that the bishop and the archbishop he served recognized that he was at least trying. And even more important, that someone whose judgment he deeply respected found his efforts satisfactory. Wagner watched the young priest on the other side of his desk and knew exactly what Wilson was thinking. He couldn't have thought anything else and been who he was. And the bishop never doubted that he'd just embarrassed the intendant. But there were times when any child of God needed to be commended, needed to be given the positive reinforcement of knowing he or she was truly valued, truly important in his or her own right. And when someone had given, lost, as much as this young man had in the service of God, it was at least as important to Heinrich Wagner to tell him how much he was valued as it could ever be for Pater Wilson to hear it. Wilson began, then hesitated. He closed his mouth, then opened it again, but Wagner raised his right hand in a stop gesture and smiled gently.
"Father, you're young. And I just embarrassed you horribly, didn't I?"
His smile grew broader, his brown eyes twinkling, and Wilson, despite the cocoon of grief he could never quite break free of, felt himself smiling back.
"Well, actually, yes, my lord." "Of course I have. But the writ tells us it's as much our responsibility to know and to acknowledge virtue as it is to recognize and condemn sin. Or, as the Archangel Bedard put it, simply learning what it's wrong for us to do isn't enough unless we're also given examples of what it's right for us to do. In that regard, you can think of this as an example of my discharging my pastoral responsibility to you in obedience to both those commands. And you might also think of it as a lesson by example for you to apply in your own ministry when it comes time for you to praise someone else."
"I'll try to remember that, my lord."
"I'm sure you will. However, that was only the first thing I wished to speak to you about."
"Yes, my lord," Wilson said, when Wagner paused yet again.
"Actually," the bishop said, in the tone of the man who'd suddenly been struck by a happy inspiration, "perhaps it would be simpler, or better at least, for me to let someone else talk to you about this particular point, Father."
Wilson frowned, perplexed by the bishop's almost whimsical smile, but Wagner simply stood, walked to his office door, and opened it.
"Would you ask them to step in now, please, Father?"
he said to the underpriest, who had escorted Wilson into the office. Wilson couldn't hear the reply, but he twisted halfway around in his chair so he could watch as the bishop stood to one side of the door, waiting patiently. Then someone stepped through it. Pater Wilson never remembered, then or later, getting out of that chair. Never remembered how he crossed between it and the door. Never remembered what, if anything, he said as he did it. The only thing he ever remembered was the feel of his arms around Lisbeth Wilson, the feel of her arms around him, the sight of his sisters, his brothers, his brother-in-law, his infant nephew. All of them, crowding into Michael Stainer's office while tears poured down their cheeks and his. Bishop Heinrich Wagner watched for a moment, smiling, seeing the tears, the joy, the grief, the love, listening to the babble of voices, the exclamations of wonder. Then, very gently, he stepped out into the anteroom and closed the door behind him. He turned to find his secretary looking at him, beaming hugely, and he smiled back.
"Some days, Father," he said quietly, "it's easier than others to remember how good God truly is, isn't it?"
July, Year of God, 894. 1. King Gorgia's Bedchamber, Royal Palace, City of Trangier, Kingdom of Taro. King Gorgia woke up rather abruptly. A hand suddenly clamped over one's mouth in the middle of the night tended to have that effect, especially upon a king whose bedchamber was at the top of the central keep of an old-fashioned castle, well provided with guardsmen. His eyes flew open, and he started to struggle, only to stop almost instantly. There were two reasons for that. One was that the hand over his mouth might as well have been a gentle, hand-shaped steel clamp. The other was that he'd just become aware of the tip of what seemed to be an exceedingly sharp dagger pressed against the base of his throat. The night, he decided, was going rapidly from bad to worse.
"I'd appreciate it if you'd be calm, Your Majesty," a tenor voice he'd never heard before in his life said. "If I'd only wanted to cut your throat, I wouldn't have bothered to wake you up first."
The calm voice sounded almost insanely reasonable, like that of a man simply pointing out that thunderclouds often meant rain. Gorgia could just make out the silhouette of a man's head against the dim glow of the bedchamber's gauzy moonstruck drapes, and he felt a stab of gratitude that Roland was having a fretful night and Mile had insisted on having her own bed made up in the nursery tonight. At the time, he'd thought it was charmingly sweet of her to want to personally oversee the nurses. At the moment, he was deeply grateful that at least his wife and son were somewhere else. "On the other hand," the voice went on pleasantly, "I'm quite sure that if, for some reason, I decided I did want to cut your throat, I could do it long before any of your guardsmen could respond to any shout on your part. If I decided to take my hand off of your mouth so the two of us could speak as one civilized man to another, do you think you could bear that in mind? The bit about my being able to kill you before anyone else gets here, I mean?" Gorgia decided the owner of the voice must be mad. Still, he was very much in favor of anything which left him with his throat uncut, and so he nodded firmly.
"Excellent."
The hand left his mouth, and the man to whom it belonged bowed slightly. Gorgia's eyes were able to pick out a little more detail now, and he realized the intruder in his bedchamber was considerably taller and broader in the shoulders than he himself. He also appeared to be clean-shaven, and he spoke with what Gorgia now recognized as a Silkayan accent.
"I apologize for my unconventional methods, Your Majesty. I really do need to speak to you, though,
and I'm of the opinion that neither of us would like your guardsmen, your courtiers, or especially Vicar Jaspar to become aware of the fact that we have." Gorgia's stomach seemed to congeal. He couldn't be certain in the dimness, but it looked to him as if his visitor had smiled. "The thing is, Your Majesty," the Silkayan continued chattily, "I thought it might be a good idea for me to give a little nudge to your correspondence with Earl Grey Harbor. You may not be aware that by this time their majesties will have arrived back in Telisburg, but I imagine that probably means the somewhat desultory pace of that correspondence will be picking up in the next few 5 days." Gorgia felt as if someone had just punched him. No one in Trangier, no one, with the exception of Sir Rick Farman, knew about the cautious notes which had passed back and forth between him and the Empire of Caris's first counselor. He hadn't mentioned them even to Baron Stonekeep. So how did whoever this was... "I don't know what you're talking about," he managed to get out. Even to his own ears, though, it sounded like an automatic, instinctive denial, with very little relationship to the truth. "Your Majesty," the Silkayan chided, and actually clicked his tongue at the king. "You know perfectly well what I'm referring to," he continued scoldingly. "I'm afraid we don't have time to stand around all night while you deny it, though. And no, Sir Rick isn't how I found out about it." The casual reference to Farman was the final blow. Obviously, whoever this lunatic was, he knew everything. "All right," Gorgia sighed. "Of course I know what you're talking about. But who the Shanwei are you, and what are you doing in my bedchamber?" "Much better, Your Majesty," the other man said in an approving tone. "As for introductions, my name is Abraham Jevons. I know that doesn't mean anything to you, but you can think of me as a close friend of Merlin Athrawis. Of course, you're familiar with that name." "Of course I am," Gorgia said slowly, and his eyes narrowed. Everyone in the world knew Merlin Athrawis was a Sajan. If this fellow, this Jevons, was a close friend of his, that might explain how he came to be in Gorgia's bedroom in the middle of the night. Even as he considered that, the king was aware of a vast sense of ill usage. After so many centuries without a single confirmed, genuine sighting of a Sajan, it seemed particularly unfair that Caleb of Caris should have an apparently unlimited number of them when Gorgia didn't even have one. "Should I take it then," he asked his visitor, "that you're also a Sajan?" "Let's just say that, like Merlin, I possess a few of the talents and abilities ascribed to Sajans," Jevons replied. "And since he's unfortunately still some 5 days out of Telisburg, on his way home from Coruscant at the moment, you might say I'm deputizing for him."
"I see."
Gorgia gazed at the dimly seen profile for a few moments, then shrugged. "Since you appear to be here as a messenger, may I at least sit up in bed without your dagger doing anything hasty?"
"By all means, Your Majesty," Jevons agreed courteously.
"Thank you."
Gorgia would really have liked to stand, if only to assert a modicum of control over the situation. On the other hand, he doubted he'd be all that imposing in his nightshirt. So he settled for arranging his pillows behind his shoulders, then cocked his head.
"Very well, Sajan Abraham. What exactly did you want to discuss?"
"Basically, I just thought it might be a good idea to drop by and introduce myself."
Teeth gleamed in a fleeting smile.
"I feel reasonably confident that, in the fullness of time, your correspondence with Earl Grey Harbor is going to lead to a satisfactory outcome for all concerned. In the meantime, though, it seemed likely to me that while I was here, just introducing myself, you understand, you'd also like to know Admiral Rockpoint's about to be reinforced. I believe it's what's known as bringing an additional argument to bear."
"I beg your pardon," Gorgia said a bit more sharply.
He knew exactly what Rockpoint's current strength was, given the fact that the cheeky Carizian had set up permanent housekeeping in Holm Reach. Of course, most of his galleons were usually out cruising around, enforcing the blockade around the rest of the Taroisian coast, and carrying out the occasional raid on some minor Desnarian port on the other side of the Taro Channel. By now, however, all of them had cycled through the anchorage off Hourglass Island at least once. There'd been plenty of time for his observers to identify each of them by name, which was about all he'd been able to do about the Carizian infestation of his territorial waters. "I said Admiral Rockpoint is about to be reinforced," Jevons repeated obligingly. "At the moment, I believe, he's scheduled to be brought up to 40 galleons." Gorger resisted a sudden urge to swallow. "And by a peculiar coincidence, there happened to be about 20,000 Imperial Marines available to go aboard transports in Old Caris, if they should find it necessary to make a cruise." This time, Gorja went ahead and swallowed. 20,000 Carizian Marines, with the new rifled muskets and artillery, and siege guns to deal with any fortifications that happened to get in their way? They'd go through his own small army like shit through a wyvern.
"Are you saying Caleb is going to invade my kingdom?" he asked very carefully.
"I'm saying Caleb and Charlian would very much prefer not to invade your kingdom," Jevons said pleasantly. "Which brings me back to the little matter of your correspondence with Earl Grey Harbor. I think everyone would be happier if this could be settled without any unnecessary unpleasantness."
Gorja stared at his mostly invisible visitor for a moment. Then he surprised himself with a harsh crack of laughter.
"I must say, Sajan Abraham, that you have a most peculiar negotiating style."
"Oh, I'm not negotiating, Your Majesty.
I'm simply pointing out that you might consider whether or not it behooves you to negotiate a bit more briskly with the Earl."
"I see." Gorja contemplated the other man for several more seconds.
"May I ask whether or not Caleb and Charlian are as prepared to be as reasonable as the Earl has suggested?"
"I think you might look at Narman in that regard," Jevons said in a rather more serious tone. "I'm not in a position to make any promises on their Majesty's behalf, but it does seem to me that leaving aside that little matter of a violated treaty, Taro's actually done less damage to Old Caris than Emerald had before they reached their understanding with him. And frankly, considering Taro's geographic position, you'd have quite a bit to offer the Empire. So..."
He let his voice trail off and shrugged, and Gorja felt his lips quivering on the edge of an involuntary smile.
"You do have a peculiar negotiating style," he said, "but I take your point. May I assume that if I were to give you a message for the Earl, or for that matter for their Majesties, you could see to it that it was delivered?"
"Not immediately," Jevons said, and Gorja's eyebrows rose in surprise. "I have a couple of other small missions I have to take care of before I head back to Old Caris, Your Majesty," the Sajan explained. "My transportation arrangements and schedule are based on my dealing with them. I think you'd probably be able to get a message back to Telesburg through Sir Rick's established channels rather more quickly than I could, actually."
"I see."
Gorja's brain whirred as he tried to imagine what other small missions Jevons might have on his calendar. Not that he had any intention of asking.
"If I might make one teeny-tiny suggestion," Jevons continued, holding up an index finger and thumb about a half inch apart. "I'd go ahead and address your next note directly to Caleb and Charlian, if they're not already in Telesburg. I'm sure they will be by the time it arrives."
"I see," Gorja repeated. He shook his head. "I believe I'll probably take your advice, Sajan."
"Good. And in that case, Your Majesty, I suppose it's time I was going."
The Sajan moved across the room to an open fifth-floor window. It's been an enjoyable chat, he continued, pushing the drapes to either side, sitting on the windowsill, and then swinging his legs out the opening. But I do have those other little responsibilities. Good night, Your Majesty. He turned lithely, dropped off the window ledge, caught it briefly with his hands for a moment, then released it with one hand to wave cheerfully before he let go entirely and disappeared. For an instant, Gorgia stared disbelievingly at the suddenly empty window. Then he flung himself out of bed, dashed over, and looked down. Despite his disbelief, he wasn't really surprised when he didn't see a smashed Sajan lying on the pavement of the courtyard below. Not that not seeing it told him a single damned thing about how his visitor had managed to get in and out of his bedchamber. Well, he thought, one thing certain. At least now I know all of the tall tales about Sajans are true. 2. Merlin Athrawas's Recon Skimmer, above Howl Bay, Kingdom of Old Karas. You enjoyed that entirely too much, Merlin Athrawas, Charlian Armok scolded. Nonsense, Merlin replied airily. He leaned back comfortably in the recon skimmer's flight couch, gazing down on the dark mass of the island continent of Karas. From his present location, he could actually see the lights of Telesburg, one of which undoubtedly represented Charlian's bedroom window. I was simply attempting to establish the proper collegial atmosphere. Collegial atmosphere, is it? Caleb snorted over his own comm. Do you think you could bear that in mind, the bit about my being able to kill you before anyone else gets here, I mean, I believe you said? Yes, that was a witty line, wasn't it? Merlin observed in a pleased tone. I thought it got his attention quite nicely.
Merlin, diplomacy isn't supposed to be fun, Narman chimed in.
Of course not, Your Highness. Now tell me with a straight face that you wouldn't have enjoyed doing exactly the same thing.
Of course I would have. In fact, that's why it was particularly rude of you to do it, when you know perfectly well none of the rest of us could do it. I'm sure you're all enjoying yourselves enormously, Michael Steiner said. If I might point out, however, it's going to be dawn in about another 2 hours here aboard ship, Merlin. Are you going to be back and aboard with all of your foliage back in place before someone notices your absence?
Back and aboard, yes, Your Eminence, Merlin said, checking the steady regrowth of his mustachios and beard with the fingers of one hand. I'm not entirely certain about the foliage, though. You may have to cover for me for an hour or so.
You know, Steiner said meditatively, before I met you, I was very seldom forced to prevaricate, much less lie outright.
Only because no one was asking you the right questions, Merlin pointed out. Besides, this time you won't have to lie at all. I will be there, and I will be meditating. Or at least reviewing Owl's latest take, and that's basically the same thing. Besides, you're an archbishop. If you'd prefer... All you have to tell anyone who wants to visit me is because I said not, and I'm the archbishop, that's why.
You really are in a cheerful mood, aren't you? Caleb observed.
As a matter of fact, yes.
Merlin lowered his hand and gazed up and out of his bubble canopy at the pinprick diamonds of Safehold's heavens.
All joking aside, I think my little meeting went quite well. I'm certain Gorgia is going to be writing to you soon, Caleb, and it won't hurt a bit for him to remember a Sajan can creep in and out of his bedroom window any time he feels like it. I don't think he's one of those naturally traitorous souls like Zebediah, but giving him a little added incentive to keep any promises he makes, this time around at least, is probably a good thing, don't you think?
I don't see how it could hurt. Caleb agreed.
Besides, I'm beginning to like Sajan Abraham, and he's turning out to be quite a useful fellow.
That's true, Charlian said. Being able to stay in touch with one another, wherever you happen to be, lets us do things like sending you to Coruscant with Michael. But Sajan Merlin still can't be in more than one place at a time. I'd just as soon not have Clintan, or especially Trenaire, starting to ask himself where all these Sajans came from all of a sudden. But establishing that there's more than one of you, and that all of you are just as mysterious as the original Merlin, gives us a lot more flexibility.
Exactly, Merlin nodded. Then he sighed suddenly.
What? Caleb asked.
I just wish there were a way for us to drop another Sajan in on Gwillem, Merlin said, his expression far more pensive.
I agree, but he's doing well enough so far on his own, Caleb replied, and Charlian nodded vigorously.
I have to admit, I was a little nervous when you told me he was planning on sailing straight into Shui Bay, she said. I was afraid he was displaying a bit too much of that thing you told us about the other day, chutzpah.
You weren't the only one, Merlin said feelingly.
Gwillem Manthir was showing a pronounced gift for taking what the military liked to call calculated risks, at least when they succeeded. They tended to call them something else when they didn't succeed. Of course, Manthir had been Caleb's flag captain, Merlin reflected. Having watched his then-crown prince sail an entire squadron through a channel he couldn't even see in the middle of the night and in a howling gale, it was probably inevitable that his definition of acceptable risk should have acquired a certain elasticity.
On the other hand, sailing his entire squadron through Shui Mouth and then clear up the Yushai Inlet was just a bit more elastic than would have been good for my circulatory system, assuming I still had one.
Yet he had to admit it had worked out. Manthir had made his final approach to the city under cover of darkness, using local fishermen as pilots. Yushai's garrison hadn't expected him until early afternoon at the earliest. When he'd actually launched his attack on the harbor at dawn, he'd caught them napping. The local batteries had been more dangerous than they would have been as little as a year before, since the Harchongese had given a high priority to producing fortress artillery to protect their building capacity. But Manthir had gone in close anyway, anchored by the stern, and laid down rolling broadside fire from 10 of his galleons. In the event, he'd been lucky in several ways, including the fact that the wind had been setting from the east-northeast when he actually attacked. It hadn't been a particularly strong wind, which had made things interesting for the 9 galleons, including Prince of Dolar, told off to attack the Harchongese's newly built warships when the harbor defense galleys sortied. On the other hand, it had also meant the blinding banks of smoke had built up in layered walls between his ships and the defensive batteries and then stayed there. The smoke screen of his own broadsides had done far more than the storm of grape shot and round shot with which he'd swept the batteries to protect his galleons and schooners from the defenders. HMS North Bay had lost her mainmast anyway, and her sister ship, Rock Point, had suffered over 60 casualties when 2 of the new, big Harchongese galleys managed to claw through her broadsides and run alongside. Fortunately, that was about the best the galleys had managed. Not for want of trying or lack of courage, but in the face of such complete surprise, they'd never managed to get organized. They'd sortied from the inner harbor in whatever order they could, coming in piecemeal, and Manthir's galleons, despite their own anemic wind-limited mobility, had cut them up badly as they attacked in dribs and drabs. In fact, his squadron had sunk 2 and captured 17 of them, and the handful of shaken survivors had beaten a sullen retreat. All the captured ships had been burned once their crews had been taken off, which would have been eminently worthwhile in its own right. but Manthir had also converted half a dozen captured coasters into fireships, stuffed to the deckheads with turpentine, old sails, barrels of pitch, and every other flammable substance. One had drifted off course when the tiller ropes burned through too quickly. A second had been grappled by a particularly courageous galley skipper and towed clear. But the other four had made no mistake. Their volunteer crews had fired them at almost exactly the right moment and taken to their own boats just before their flaming vessels sailed directly into the closely moored hulls of 15 Imperial Harchong Navy galleons, still in the process of fitting out. 12 of those galleons had become total losses, and one of the survivors had been badly damaged. 2 more had survived only because they'd been upwind from the initial fire, and their fast-thinking crews had been given just enough time to scuttle them before the holocaust sweeping through their consorts reached them. They'd settled to the shallow bottom with only their upper decks above water, and the Harchongese seamen had managed to keep the still exposed portions of their ships from catching fire. Even so, they were going to be out of service for months while they were pumped out, raised, and then repaired. It would have been even better if Manthir had been able to administer the same treatment to Gorath Bay, but fortunately, he showed no signs of lapsing into outright insanity.
I agree he's doing well. Extremely well, especially considering that he doesn't have any access to the Snarks, Merlin said. In fact, the damage he's already done completely justifies sending him out in the first place. And if the Dolorans are feeling more confident after Yushai, the Harchongese aren't. I just wish there were some way we could get him that access.
The Sajan shook his head.
I'm afraid he's underestimating how quickly Thirsk's strength is building up.
He may be, Caleb conceded. Unfortunately, as you pointed out to me before Harrell's Crossing, there are still going to be times when we have information we just can't figure out how to share with the people who need it. And even though he probably doesn't realize how badly he's about to be outnumbered, he's taking it for granted he will be outnumbered when the moment comes. When you come down to it, aside from telling him exactly where Thirsk is at any given moment, that's really all we could tell him from the Snarks anyway.
I know, Merlin sighed. It's just
that you worry about friends, Merlin, Caleb said with a soft, sad little chuckle.
We know. Believe us, we know.
3. Imperial Palace, City of Talisburg, Kingdom of Old Karras.
I'm sure Father Omar is on his way, Your Majesty.
It was a sign of just how flustered Sarai Hallman was that she'd slipped and forgotten the proper protocol here in the Kingdom of Old Karras, reverting to the older, more familiar form of address, and forgetting that in Talisburg, Charlian was officially Your Grace and not Your Majesty. Not that Charlian was in any mood to correct such minor lapses. She was too busy pursing her lips and breathing out hard while she squeezed Caleb's hand fiercely. The spasm eased, and she dropped her head back on the pillow, panting.
He'd better get here soon, she said then, between pants. Someone else is going to be here, whether he is or not.
This is ridiculous, Caleb muttered, taking a fresh cloth from Sarai and blotting sweat from Charlian's forehead.
You're the Empress, dammit. He's supposed to be here, waiting when you go into labor.
At the moment, he could cheerfully have strangled Father Omar Arthman, despite the fact that he was normally very fond of Talisburg's leading obstetrician.
Starting tomorrow, he told himself firmly, Father Omar has a nice suite right here in the palace, dammit. I'll keep the thing handy for the next kid, by God. I am not supposed to have to send someone 6 blocks to a frigging hospital monastery when my wife goes into labor.
Don't panic. Charlian reached across to pat the hand she held with her other hand.
They're not all that close together yet, and my water hasn't even broken. There's time.
Caleb would have been happier if her tone had sounded a bit more positive and a bit less hopeful. Besides, he probably expected Sister Frances to give him more warning than this. And it's not his fault I decided to start doing this in the middle of the night, either.
No, but...
Oh, hush, she commanded, and began breathing deeply once again. The contractions were coming closer together, and she wasn't enjoying it one bit. On the other hand, it wasn't as bad as she'd been half afraid it would be. Not yet, at least. And her mother had assured her that women in her family always had easy deliveries. Of course, there was a first time for everything, including hard deliveries. And there had been all that morning sickness.
And now that I think about it, where the hell is Sister Frances? The Emperor demanded.
Little Tyrion, his wife panted, as the fresh contraction eased.
What?
Caleb stared at her. Sister Frances Sawyer, the Pasquillate nun who'd accompanied them back from Chiraeth aboard Empress of Caris, was a sister of the Convent of the Blessed Hand, which specialized in pregnancies. Which meant, despite the rote nature of the Book of Pasquale's teachings, that she was a skilled obstetrician.
What in hell's name is she doing there? He more than half snarled.
My fault.
Charlian smiled apologetically while he blotted more sweat.
She wanted to go visit the convent there. With Father Omar right here, I told her it would be all right. In fact, I insisted she go.
You and...
Caleb began incredulously, then made himself stop and draw a deep breath of his own.
I take it when you said insisted, you mean insisted, he said instead. Of course she did.
Sarai's tone was the exasperated one of someone who'd served Charlian since she'd been a little girl. The maid shook her head, taking the cloth Caleb passed to her and handing him a fresh one.
You know what she's like, Your Majesty. Stubborn, always knows best, never listens to anyone, always worrying about someone else, always has her own way, never...
I'm sure he's got the entire catalogue, Sarai, Charlian said dryly.
Not but what you're right. She did argue, and I did insist.
She smiled crookedly at her husband.
And now that I think about it, I told her I'd tell Father Omar she was going, and I sort of forgot to.
Of course you did.
Caleb rolled his eyes and snorted. Then he smiled back at her and shook his head.
You do realize you're probably the only empress in the entire world who could arrange things so there was no one to call on when she went into labor? I thought it was the husband who was supposed to be running around like a lunatic.
I am not running around like a lunatic, Charlian told him firmly. I've just been a little absent-minded for the last few days.
That's one way to put it, he said feelingly.
Oh, hush, she said again. Besides, I was really hoping this wouldn't happen until Michael and...
She broke off with another quick smile, and he patted the back of the hand he held and nodded. HMS Dawn Wind was becalmed, still 3 days out from Dolphin Reach. He and Charlian had both hoped the galleon would reach Talisburg with Michael Stainair and Merlin Athrawis before their child was born. They'd known the odds were against it when Dawn Wind made an unusually slow passage from Coruscant, but they'd still hoped. And now...
Caleb, Charlian said.
Yes?
You remember what I said about my water not having broken?
Yes, he repeated rather more slowly.
Well, I'm afraid that's no longer accurate.
Wonderful.
Caleb looked across at Sarai.
You go out that door,
he said, pointing at the royal bedchamber's ornately carved panels,
and you find Edward, and you tell him I said for one of you to find Father Omar now.
His voice was completely calm, but Sarai Hallman's eyes widened.
Yes, Your Majesty,
she squeaked, and disappeared like a puff of smoke.